as we all know, we're living in a time of maximum disjunction, a coming apart, a time of conflicts, omnipresent conflicts at every level of the fractalized cosmos. And yet it's punctuated by moments of very paradoxical conjunctions and superpositions. And this day is one of those very profound conjunctions in which three holy days are juxtaposed, come together within traditions that are not in rapport, and yet the meaning of which in all of them is identical. And it's that strange paradox of identity and alienation that is the hallmark of ego consciousness. And so we have three holidays, the Hindu holiday of Hanuman Jayanti, which is the mythical birth of the mythical hero Hanuman from the famous epic, the Ramayana, which we have studied here. And Hanuman, of course, symbolizes, well, there are many levels of the symbol, but primarily the divinization of our animal nature, the transformation of the monkey mind into the mind of, if not God, then such a total devotee of God that in that adoration there is union and no longer any alienation or separation. So we could say that in the paradigm of the Ramayana, you have Rama signifying God consciousness, Sita as the soul, and the soul becomes captured by the lower animal nature that has not been divinized but still has its bestial, if you wish, attributes or traits of jouissance, of gratification of the sensory level of the bodily vehicle that is out of touch with the true nature of its being as pure consciousness that is infinite and not localizable in a bodily form. And it happens because, if you remember the story, Sita is giving alms, a coin, to a Brahmin priest who comes as a beggar, and she's not allowed to leave the magic circle. But out of a misplaced moment of empathy, she gives the coin and her fingernail traverses the edge of the circle and she's captured and taken to the island outpost of that demonic ten-headed entity named Ravana and becomes enslaved, we could say, or at least captivated by the lower nature of ego consciousness and its intensities that have not been divinized. And we could say that Hanuman represents the soul, the divinized aspect of consciousness that saves the part of the soul that is represented by Sita, who has fallen, the nature of the soul that has identified with the body ego and has become split. And that split nature then is healed as Hanuman is able to bring the divinization of consciousness into effect, both as the warrior who defeats the lower drives and raises the consciousness of the soul back to God, and also brings those famous healing herbs for those wounded in the battle. In other words, our traumas that we have suffered in the fall into body consciousness are healed by the same power that defeats the identification with the ego mind. And thus, the battle being won, Sita and Ram are reunited, and the Ram Rajya is able to then take place. The kingdom of God can be restored. So at the same time, we're celebrating the Israelite holiday of Pesach, the Passover, in which the enslaved Israelites rise up against their masters, and with divine help, namely the angel of death, that passes over. And we need to understand this, of course, internally, as we do every myth. The angel of death brings about the ego death of those who had been enslaved to the ego, which enables the Red Sea to part, enables the opening of consciousness to break through its enslaved condition and be able to enter into the journey to the holy mountain, where the light of God, the burning tree of life, is able to be encountered fully, and God consciousness and its dharma, its mitzvot, its commandments, its way of expressing life in a divine manner is given. At least that's the mythological interpretation. And then we have, of course, in the Islamic tradition, this is the beginning of the season of the Hajj, the pilgrimage to the holy Kaaba stone in Mecca, which I suggest signifies the zero point of consciousness. But of course, the zero point of consciousness is not located in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else, just as the holy mountain is not located in the Sinai desert, nor is the kingdom of heaven located in a city in India. The kingdom is laid out before us all if our third eye is open and we are able to see, as Christ has said in the Gospel of Thomas. And of course, the Passover meal is also the Last Supper, signifying the passion of Christ to come and the rising of consciousness, the return of consciousness to the Father, to the Godhead, to the Absolute Self, and the divinization of the human consciousness that can now abide, no longer split, but unified with the one infinite consciousness that encompasses, pervades, and acts through every node of its manifest forms. So each of these three holidays is signifying the same internal journey to the source, to the from the unreal to the real, from darkness to light, from the world of death to that of eternity. The problem, I would suggest, of Kali Yuga is that in the first place, the real that is God became confused with the religious belief in God. Because the God that one believes in cannot be the same as the real God. Because no belief system can actually grasp the infinite, incomprehensible, inconceivable nature of the intelligence, the beauty, the power of God. No belief system, therefore, can have a monopoly on truth. But once we have fallen into ego consciousness and we mistake religion for God and substitute the former for the latter, we become loyal to an institution of signifiers and a particular tradition that is now in opposition to other traditions with different signifiers, different holy scriptures, different mythologies. And even though they are all congruent and all signify the same truth, because that truth is beyond the symbolic, those who are identified with language, with thought, with the mental activity in the mind that is no longer under their control, but which turns the ego itself into an artifact of the mental stream of consciousness, there is no longer any power to discern the difference between the belief in God and God, or in the righteousness of the teachings of a religion from the truth of the presence of the intelligence of God that can transcend and must transcend any list of commandments or dharmic values. And because of that, the limited mind in a contracted state has then become an instrument of the misuse of faith and the misuse of self-righteousness to foment religious wars and conflicts between empires whose organizing principle is the faith that one lives for and dies for and must be willing to kill for that belief system and the orders given by those who represent that system, rather than returning to the real of God consciousness, which is beyond any limited frame of reference or motivation of conquest or defense or justification or belief in one's chosenness or the chosenness of a particular piece of land or the chosenness of a scripture or of a a particular way of life. And so once the particular wins out over the universal and the surrender to a particular group overcomes the loyalty to that infinite presence that contains all as equal manifestations of the same absolute self, then the world comes apart. And at every fractal level, that coming apart replicates itself. And then we have a further historical development in the West, which attempts to overcome this problem by repressing religion and the values, the traditional values of religion, and to replace it with secularism based on a pseudo-religion of scientism. And this Western heresy that becomes a new orthodoxy for Western Europe, the US, Canada, and all of those contained within the empire of the globalized capitalist system, become necessarily indoctrinated into the belief in scientism. And its teachings include the replacement of God as creator with Darwinism, with evolution, but evolution of a kind that is based on random mutations. And therefore, the whole development of life loses its meaning. And that frame of reference, and that paradigm of reality, literally the world becomes meaningless. And at the same time, the physicists say, we don't need God anymore. We have a Big Bang, and we have our belief that everything can be explained in terms of mathematics. No God is necessary. And even though there are clearly inadequacies to such a paradigm, it is taught and mandated in such a way that it is irresistible to those brought up in a Western cultural framework. Moreover, scientism offers, via technology, a force that they can claim is more powerful than prayer. They have modern medicine. They have the ability to communicate globally. They have weapons of mass destruction that can conquer everyone. They have proved that the scientistic belief system is superior to religion. But the problem, of course, is that technology, being meaningless, leads to a very oppressive and tyrannical transhumanism in which a eugenicist program of depopulation becomes inevitable because there is no longer a need once the development of artificial intelligence and robotics develops to a certain point of having the masses of bodies that are now inconvenient to the holders of power and threaten their rule. And so you have a situation where an empire becomes illegitimate through its own turning against its population, which then creates a backlash of a return to religion. But now a religion that is in a much more primitivized form that is extremely defensive and reactive rather than focused on the elevation of consciousness to the level of the God self, but now of trying to hold on to a disappearing value system to prevent the complete neutering of the population and the perversion of all the traditional ideals and values. And so we have a war that is really, I think, best summed up as a war of God, the real God, versus both religion and scientism and technology. But because the ego consciousness cannot grasp the real God and can no longer surrender to the real God because it cannot stop its own mind from producing illusory thoughts, emotions, and attitudes based on its bodily self-concept, it finds itself in a hopeless and tragic situation in which the fear of death clouds its judgment and causes a partialization and a fanaticization of consciousness in a vain and desperate attempt to bring order to the growing chaos. And at the same time that this is happening, the consciousness of the human species as a whole, both due to social engineering and the dumbing down of the educational systems and the weaponization of the educational systems, has brought about a loss of that level of consciousness that can think critically and clearly and can even become cognizant that there are levels of consciousness that transcend its own limited potential for understanding the whole. One cannot discern the limits of one's own capacity for discernment. You cannot know what you do not know and how much you do not know. And so that ignorance then propels the consciousness to act out at a level of its own pseudo-understanding that is inadequate to meet the challenges of the moment. And the dumbing down of consciousness has brought about a situation where a society that has now become dependent upon an engineering intelligentsia to provide stability of very fragile structures like international electric grids and nuclear reactors and hair trigger response systems to threatened attacks, etc., etc., can no longer function to sustain itself. And ever more glitches appear in the system. And this, of course, is augmented by a capitalist system's profit motive in producing the cheapest possible product for the maximal profit, and thus very shoddy kinds of airplanes are now being produced, and even weaponry, and of course we even have sabotage of industries like the pharmaceutical because of various other programs covertly being implemented via these possibilities of social hypnotic suggestion and health mandates and scare factors about climate change, et cetera, that everyone is very familiar with. And so in this situation, there is such a sense of despair and hopelessness and chaos and fear and a sense of being so clueless as to how to find a way out of the trap that the world has fallen into, that is seemingly inevitably now approaching a culmination in an apocalyptic eschaton. And part of the problem is that the religious systems that are still functioning, whether in the form of backlash or in the form of cultures such as those in Iran and Russia, which have managed to sustain or at least rebuild their religious cultures, their belief system includes a belief in the inevitability of apocalypse, of a violent end of time. And because the holy scriptures of these religions, all three of the Abrahamic religions, but it's also present in Buddhism and in Hinduism, creates a self-fulfilling prophecy that leads those who are believers into actually accelerating the process of bringing about this apocalyptic eschaton as a way of bringing God back to the world. And at the same time, the secularists are in an unholy war against the religionists and against all rival powers to the hegemony of a waning empire that's crashing and bankrupt. And this is leading to a situation of an impending war of all against all. And because of the fractal nature of the cosmos, the same kind of chaotic internal conflicts are happening within each individual at the ego level. And people are more and more torn between lower death drive and upper death drive, and between drives of compassion and drives of fury and self-righteous genocide and murder of the demonized other. And all of this is taking place at every level of society, of family systems, and, as I say, of individuals. And it's a rare being who is able to avoid the effects of these kinds of internal and external conflicts. So, to understand this in a way which enables the integrity of the cosmic consciousness in which all of this is being manifested, one must then return to the recognition that to reach God, there must be a complete disidentification from the consciousness that is identified with the body and with the operating system of the body that is embedded as language, and language as connected to drives that cannot be controlled so long as the mind cannot be controlled. And that control can only be gained through ego death. But the ego death cannot happen until the awakening of the soul, which cannot be awakened because the mind stream is in such an agitated state that the soul can never discern its nature from the nature of the mental objects that are filling its consciousness and providing an obscuring lens upon reality that turns it into a place in which its internal conflicts are projected as external ones. And the feedback loop between the internal and the external, the quantum wave function and the qualium wave function, are such that each accelerates the further collapse and ultimate self-destruction of the other. So to overcome this catch-22, there has to be a radical and instantaneous break with the implicit belief that the mental movements of thoughts in the mind are your thoughts. And similarly, a break in the belief that those thoughts are valid. And it has to be radical. And this is nearly impossible to be done unless there is an act of grace that comes from your inner Hanuman, the divinized aspect of your soul, that can suddenly provide a field of silence in which the absurdity of the ego and its acting out can be recognized and not caught into the trap of self-hatred, which is just another egoic, super-egoic conflict, but is able to be so free of that identification and is able to turn to the field of luminous power of the infinite God self that egoic operating system can be demolished, annihilated once and for all. And this has to happen instantaneously and cannot be accomplished by the ego, but only by the awakened soul that has surrendered in adoration and devotion to the Absolute Presence that is formless and ungraspable and has been absorbed into it. And in that state then, Ravana is finally destroyed and Hanuman can bring Sita back to Rama and the world of light can replace the world of darkness and death and a new dream field can emerge that can, in fact, manifest as a heavenly realm of peace and harmony and joy and love and beauty and divine consciousness, fully empowered as it was originally and as it is designed and meant to be through the self-overcoming that earns its right to liberation. And this is the moment that we are in, the moment of decision of whether you will accept the fatalism of the ego or you will overcome your own illusory identity and all of its attachments and all of its attitudes and all of its beliefs and incinerate them as a sacrificial act that brings freedom and the return to the real. And this alone is true yoga. which transcends all religions and is the core, originally, of the teachings of every sage who ushered a new religion into manifestation in Kali Yuga. But this can only be accomplished now by those who have sacrificed their attachment to any particular religion or philosophy or belief system, including the belief in the ego itself, and can abide in that emptiness of pure absence that is the true presence until the fullness of the real fills the consciousness and dissolves all of the fractalized fragments that have produced internal conflict, and that enables a new dream to manifest. So those who have that yearning in the heart, if you hold strongly to the practice of silencing the mind in the service of reaching the Absolute Self, the grace of redemption and liberation will be given. But the practice must be ceaseless and relentless until the sanskaras of the ego are overcome. And even though the breakthrough is instantaneous, because there are subtler and subtler echoes of the mind, even after the initial break has been achieved, there is still a possibility for a new identity, even one of an improved kind, a more soulful one, to attempt to precipitate and manifest to replace the one that was dissolved. And one must not fall into the trap of simply becoming an improved version of your ego. And so the silence must be held until all of the subtle thought forms that are latent from sanskaras that come from past lifetimes and from leftover residues of introjections of the fantasies of others have been completely eliminated from one's mental space, and the purification of consciousness has become complete. And this is why the practice of yoga requires that kind of a deep and accurate meditation practice for a long enough period so that no possibility of a relapse into the ego delusion can take place. So vigilance is required until the Eternal Self has become completely emerged in consciousness, and the I thought has been completely absorbed in the real. This is the work of Sat Yoga. So that's the message on this triple holy day in which we are celebrating the reality that all religions share the same truth. But because they use different words and myths to express it, they cannot avoid the conflict that is based on the confusion of the signifier with the signified. And we must overcome that ignorance in order to become free. So on that note, I will happily open the floor if anyone has any comments or questions about any of this. And all of this is said with the hope that those who are able to transcend the identification with a particular religion or political or philosophical system, which is these days at war with the others, who, if you can overcome that, we must in fact speak from that place of unification and not entertain or support the growing divisions between humans who are loyal to different systems and therefore to different political programs that are destructive of others in the world. Because the commandment of thou shalt not kill does not have any small print to it that gives exceptions for religious wars or for overcoming of evil. But nonviolence is an absolute for those who have realized the unity and the eternal bodiless nature of what we are. And because we are deathless, we do not engage in bringing death except to the illusion of mortality itself. May we live in that level of consciousness that can inspire and bring to the morphogenic field of the world a new consciousness in which those who are awakened continue to awaken others so that the world can end in peace and in a return to the light in which the illusion of suffering has been completely eliminated and the chaos has been pacified by the presence of that almighty power of the One Self. Namaste. So the floor is open if anyone wishes to speak or if there's anyone on the love stream.
Thank you, Shinya. Yes, we have Gyanis, Vigyanis, and Pragyanis joining us from all over the world tonight, and they're expressing a lot of gratitude for the satsang so far. We have a question from Oliver. And his question is, Christ said the kingdom of God is within you. And then he says, even many Christians prefer to ignore the deep significance and implications of this. Is there a parallel in Islam and Judaism?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. Especially in the esoteric versions, the Kabbalah for the Jews and the Sufi core of Islam. In fact, for the Sufis, they would even say is the only validity to Islam is if it is understood as a religion of love, in which God can be equally found not only in a synagogue or church as well as a mosque, but can be found in the tavern equally. And there is no difference. And everyone is a manifestation of Allah, and we are here to be drunken in ecstasy of the joy of the realization that God is all that is. The same is really spoken of in many of the Kabbalistic texts. You can find it in beautiful poetic parts of the Zohar and of other traditional texts from various moments in the development of the Kabbalah, and it's also there in the prophets of the Old Testament. So I think there's no doubt that this same teaching is present in all the three Abrahamic traditions. And moreover, when you understand the origin of those traditions in the understanding of Abraham and Sarah as disguised versions of Brahma and Saraswati, you will understand that all of those religions came from a much earlier Vedic religion, and that that same origin to which Jesus, Yeshua, went after his alleged death on the cross that was exaggerated, and his return to Kashmir, was able to then continue teaching and developing, which became the basis of Tantra in the, both the Buddhist and the Vedic traditions, the Shaivite tradition at least. And this spread, of course, into China and merged with the concord that was already present in the equally beautiful and congruent teachings of the Tao, of the unmanifest consciousness that has no name, that is the source of all that is. And so, yes, it's congruent throughout the world, and including in the native religions of the various tribal peoples. So there are no conflicts at the level of the core teachings, but in the dumbed-down exoteric versions that are given in Sunday schools and in madrasas and in yeshivas and in various other religious forms of indoctrination, this has basically been either watered down or lost. Is there anyone here with a comment or question? Yeah, Yogi Raj.
Thank you. I appreciate the teaching. Something I've been thinking about since the last retreat was this idea of the angel of death. In the Bible, there's reference to, the term is Abaddon. And it's Abaddon means destroyer. But how does that kind of correspond to, let's say, in the East, where you have Mahakal, which is the death of death? Because I had understood that as death of the illusion of death, mm-hmm. as a non-dual kind of idea. But mm-hmm. maybe you can explain how the angel mm-hmm. of death actually functions.
I would say it's the same. If you understand this myth internally, not as a historical description of a process that happened to a people, because remember, this whole story was written in Babylon, thousands of years after it allegedly occurred, and with other political intentions to be expressed in that redaction by Ezra. But the angel of death, if we understand the myth correctly, is bringing about the death of the superego, Pharaoh, right, and the Egyptian overlords, which are those aspects of the ego that confer the belief in mortality. And so it is, in effect, the death of death, which is what enables the Israelites to break free of enslavement to the fear of death, that enables them to fearlessly enter the desert and face all of the unknown with the faith in manna from heaven, because they had no food and they had no way of surviving except through divine intervention, which was given. And so if you understand this as an internal development, then it becomes a complete internal surrender to the God self without any holding on to attachment to egoic forms of security seeking.
So would you say in the process of silencing the mind, if there is any fear that comes up, it's useful to label it as the angel of death or like any of those kinds of energies?
No, I don't think labeling is a good idea. I would stay in the silence and just recognize silently that the fear is the ego's fear. And because you don't want fear, you don't accept fear, that fear will die along with the ego by simply disidentifying from the mind itself. And you'll realize the mind doesn't actually exist. The ignorance is not real. And once you don't breathe life into it, it dies immediately.
So even the labeling, even the labeling of it is in a way the affirmation of it. So it's just...
Yeah, it keeps you in the symbolic and prevents you from crossing over to the real.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
We have a question from Catherine. Could Shunyamurti talk about forgiveness? When feelings of guilt, shame, etc. come up, are we to forgive others that don't actually exist, quote unquote, or do we forgive our true self for failing?
The word forgiveness means giving forth, forthgiving, right? So what you are giving forth is divine love that is unconditional. And that divine love recognizes all as one, because that's what love is. It's the realization of unity. And in that love, there are no others. So no others don't exist, but the one self that manifests as the many is real. And that one self gives forth to itself and from itself for itself to become a world of love, in which the manyness can augment the joy, the beauty, the recognition of the infinite truth nature of the real in the unification of the manifest with the unmanifest, in the recognition that samsara and nirvana are not two, and that there is no one to be forgiven, no one to forgive, but the act of giving forth is itself the gushing out of the infinite intensity of the energy of divine love, which completely dissolves all suffering and all illusion of a world that is out of touch with that luminous infinite presence. And then a new world is dreamed from the consciousness that was many that has now again become one, and that unified network of nodes of consciousness that are now all vibrating at the same wavelength produce a dream field of harmony and beauty and a Sat Yuga, a kingdom of heaven. Okay. Please.
I have a question that I'm trying to connect three ideas to create this question. So the first one is, help me please if I'm not making much sense. The first one is the repetition of these conjunctions, of these synchronicities, of very important signs that we're seeing right now. We just had one on April 8th of the alignment of the planets, but there's been many this year. Mm-hmm. Here's yet another one, right? Three, let's say, religions or spiritual paths that are in conflict with each other in different parts of the world, etc. So I'm trying to make sense of these signs that are appearing ever more in our, let's say, in our horizon, right? In for us to see. And at the same time, the increasing conflict and chaos that's occurring in the world, And the third one is, of course, one of the main reasons why we're celebrating today, which is the archetype of the spiritual warrior and the need in this context of a world, or let's say of a phenomenal plane in which we are embedded as characters, to understand the importance of the spirit of the spiritual warrior in this time that we're living with, mm-hmm. and how does that relate to these synchronicities and also to the growing amount of chaos that we're seeing now, not every month, every day, several times a day, and attacks amongst people and mm-hmm. surprises of unexpected disloyalties and others. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. We're living in a time when everything that could go wrong, go wrong. Mm-hmm. And even things that can't go wrong, go wrong. and everything is coming apart very rapidly and accelerating in that rapidity. So yes, that is happening at the same time that the signs are obvious, but only to those with eyes to see. And if your third eye isn't open, you'll be in denial of the meaning of this. Yes, you can look at the calendar and note that these are occurring, but they don't have meaning for you, because the scientistic consciousness is literally meaningless. It doesn't believe in meaning any longer. And the religious meanings filter out the meanings from any other religious voice or tradition as invalid and demonic, right? Because only one is chosen. And so there is no, within the ego, ability to connect the dots and see the whole picture. And that's part of the paradoxical situation, that from the perspective of the absolute self is very humorous, right? Although, you know, it's tragic and chaotic at the level of the blind ego. But the real point is that there is no need to become a spiritual warrior, because that would imply that an individual does it. No, it's the power of God that activates spiritual warriorship. It's grace that does it, not an individual effort. And that grace doesn't require a quantity of beings, only a quality of consciousness of such a purity of the vibrational wavelength that it breaks through all of the obscuring noise and brings the music of the presence of God into the world in the fullness of its splendor, its glory. And this will happen as the will of God determines the moment that suddenly all will hear that miraculous symphony of the presence of divine love and harmony and beauty at the very moment of the destruction and the maximal presence of horror, evil, dread, darkness. And the evil will then be completely reabsorbed into the absolute goodness and put to an end. Much like the apocalyptic eschatologies of those religions have said, although not with their particular belief on who will win, or on what it means to be in a state of rapture, or what it means to overcome the Antichrist or the Dajjal, or whatever is the expression used in a particular tradition. But all of this will take place as the will of God, who is the playwright of this theodrama, and will determine how it unfolds and culminates in the revelation that will be universal to every soul. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a question from Christy. She asks, if one takes a vow of ahimsa, can one not practice self-defense if it involves violence towards another?
You know, I'm not going to judge that. That's a question for every individual. I remember when I was studying with Baba Hari Das, someone asked him that question, and he told a story about a snake, a poisonous snake, who took a vow of nonviolence to become a yogi, and then was attacked by a mongoose or something, you know, and he got really beat up, and he goes back, but he survived. He goes back to the guru. He said, "Hey, I took this vow of nonviolence. Look what happened to me. You know, I'm torn apart and bleeding." And the guru said, "Look, I said you couldn't kill, but that doesn't mean you can't hiss. You know? And it doesn't mean you can't defend yourself to whatever degree is necessary, but you're doing it out of the love of God and of joy, of protecting the harmony of the real, not out of fear that you're going to be hurt as a bodily being." And if you have reached that level of God consciousness, that is the total giving forth, there won't be any interest in defending yourself, because yourself doesn't need defense. The body is what wants to be defended. And when there's no longer any identification with the body, the being who has been liberated from that will be glad that somebody kills that body and lets them be free of having to hang out and keep feeding it and, you know, dealing with things in this illusory realm. So a liberated sage would tend not to want to defend their body. This was the case with Sri Ramana when some thieves and bandits of a violent kind came to the ashram and started beating up the members of the ashram, and they were going to defend themselves. And Ramana says, no, let them take whatever they want, stay in peace. And they actually beat him with some sticks and caused some bruises. And Ramana said, whatever you wish. He didn't have any interest in defending himself. So it's not like you can mandate that somebody must do that, because you'll have no control. If you're in the ego, you'll probably resort to some form of self-defense or fight or flight. But so it's not a question of having to follow a rule. You will do whatever you are inclined to do in such an extreme situation. But at a certain level of consciousness, you will realize you're not the doer, and you'll be beyond any question of what you should do, because the unfoldment will be recognized as being perfect, whatever happens. Any other last questions?
Wonderful teaching. One question is kind of formulating into my mind, and I'm not sure exactly how I can express it. One side, there's a talk of chaos in the world and everything falling apart, and another side is just observing nature and observing how the divine is manifesting all around me. And it's kind of like, without one having his head in the sand, it's kind of like I prefer to look at the divine that's surrounding me, not ignoring that things are chaotic, but it helps me somehow to liberate myself into something greater, rather than being stuck in some place where, you know, there's chaos and destruction and all that. And so I'm trying to see, do I have my head in the sand, or I know it's happening, but I prefer not to look at that, but to look at something else, which is nurturing. What's your viewpoint on that?
Yeah, it's not a question that that I'm recommending one should focus on the chaos, but for most people, it's pretty obvious and it's hard to avoid seeing, especially if you're living in a city that's collapsing and the rats are running loose. Or I've seen videos of in towns in India where warring packs of baboons are fighting huge gang wars in the streets. And I remember when I was in India, I had a few close encounters with these monkeys, and they can be pretty it's pretty tough. So and they, you know, they'll steal whatever you have, but they're running loose, and the cities and the are becoming places of massive crime and terror, and carjackings everywhere, murders constantly. So people living in major population centers have a much harder time than those living in a rural area or in an ashram where you don't need to lock your doors and you can trust that your neighbor is not going to shoot you in the middle of the night, you know. So if you live in an idyllic surrounding, it's much easier to do that than in certain situations where people find themselves karmically and may have a hard time getting out of. But I do agree with you that the ego's nightmare can be easily overcome if one looks at the divine level of the dream, not the ego level of the dream. And indeed, nature is beauty itself. Even though we must also say that the forests are being cut down and the pollution of the soil and geoengineering of the chemtrails in the skies. And right, so even at the level of nature, we're starting to see, or more than starting, we're seeing the poisoning of the natural environment as well. And we're seeing an acceleration in geophysical events like earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanoes going off, and other violent events, including solar storms and other things, which indicate that nature herself is participating in this event. And what's happening in the human sphere is part of the same intelligence that is operating at the cosmic level of consciousness. So even that beauty has to be accepted as being impermanent. And the beauty of nature, which is being destroyed by human malfeasance, must be let go of to find the supreme beauty, which is the formless absolute consciousness. And it's only in that supreme beauty that we then have the power to bring beauty back to the manifest world.
It sounds sometimes like there's a sort of like a timeline that needs to be followed, and there's a part of me that's saying, well, it's already there somehow. It's just that I'm not seeing it if I'm not at peace and I'm not completely open to seeing it.
Yeah, both are true, because there is a linear unfoldment within Chronos time. But if you're already in the Kairos movement toward the Ion, the very zero point of timeless presence, yes, you're there now. There's nothing to wait for. The world never even existed in the first place, so it really will not end. All that will end is an illusion, and that will be replaced by a more beautiful illusion. But the real is beyond all of that and unchanging. And if you've reached that level, there's no interest even in what happens in the circle of time, because one is in a place of much more inconceivable beauty and divine bliss.
And I guess that's the place to be. Just quiet the mind and the chaos stops,
right.
And then you're in that place already.
Absolutely correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any last questions? No? All right. Is everyone satisfied? at peace with a silent mind and a heart full of giving forth of divine love. May it be so. I hope that that this satsang was helpful to remove whatever blockages there might have been to your realization of your divine nature, and that you experience your freedom from the illusion of any limitation or any sense of being a creature who was born into a world, rather than the consciousness that is the creative power that brings worlds into manifestation, sustains them, evolves them, and then dissolves them back into the singularity of the light, which is where we are now at this point at the end of the cycle of time. And so may we all return to that light that we are, in the blissful self-redemption of a consciousness that really never had fallen at all into the illusion. But it was an illusion that we were in the illusion, and that always we are the dreamer of the manifold dream of every possible permutation of the relationship of beauty and truth. Namaste.
Namaste.